this small device over here is really Mark Singer.
Hi, Mark.
Gary Bravo.
If it weren't so busy recording, it would respond with a pun. I haven't seen them. They're back. They're still there.
You did.
I have not seen them shul yet. So this is indeed our final shiur for the year, and we had left certain directions last week that we wanted to explore. And part of today's shiur is the excuse for why I can't do the topics justice, and the rest of the shiur today is showing you what I have come up with in some related aspects to what we did last week. What we wanted to do was explore a little bit more regarding the Rashi that we did on the end of the life of Bruria, the wife of Rav Meir. And we also, I said that I was going to explore a little bit about, I thought I recalled an article by Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter regarding the 400 children who martyred themselves rather than be taken for immoral purposes by the Romans. So with regard to that latter point, I looked up where I had seen the reference, and it's not exactly what I had thought. I had seen a reference in a footnote in an article. The article was about the rewriting of history that's being done in so many, especially but not exclusively, right-wing works of fiction, I mean biography and history. And there was one point where Rabbi Schachter lists, it's called Facing the Truths of History in the Torah Lamada Journal, Volume 8, 1998 and 1999. So it was one of the examples.
How do you remember reading these articles?
I just happened to be reading the article, and he gives a whole bunch of examples that he doesn't go into. And one of them is the controversy over the Holocaust story of the 93 Beis Yaakov girls in Krakow.
I know that one.
And in the footnote, he refers to the article that he co-authored on the subject. And he said, the entire issue surrounding the story is presented in an article I co-authored with Judith Tidor Valmel, the 93 Beis Yaakov girls of Krakow, History or Typology, in Jacob J. Schachter edited Reverence, Righteousness, and Rachmanut, Essays in Memory of Rabbi Dr. Leo Young. So it was not what I thought it was, but from the title, and that's all I know of it right now, it sounds like he is discussing whether the account of those 93 girls martyring themselves is exact history, or is it based upon this story of the 400 and trying to show a modern day version and perhaps fiddling a little bit with the facts in order to make it fit into that typology. But that's my speculation. So it's not what I thought, so I do not have a source for discussing whether that story was pure history or how much of it. Now, concerning the Rashi, I thought that perhaps I would find something interesting in some of the books that I have at home. So thus far I have not. I amassed a library of Agadic books on Agadita over the course of last summer in preparation for this course. And none of them have anything major on the subject, to the best of my ability to search. In the course of searching, I found something interesting that I wanted to do with you. And I'll come back to it shortly, also relating to our story in another halachic reflection. And I'll come back to that. Another sefer that you should be aware of, even though it was not able to save the day today, Yonah Frankel, who's better known for his work on Agadita, and I've shown you one of the big fat volumes that he did. Before he did that, in 1980, he put out a volume called Darko Shel Rashi, B'Perusho L'Talmud HaBavli. everybody analyzes how Rashi comments on Chumash. There's so many super commentaries on Rashi. He wrote a book analyzing Rashi's derech in his commentary to the Gemara. And the first chapter is on the difficulty in pinning down the correct version of Rashi based upon the different editions of Rashi that exist. So that itself might help us understand why our Rashi might present issues in figuring out what the correct version is. Well, the most I'll be able to do for you is show you in the sources that I've laid out for you on the sheets here, is show you how there were certainly Gedolei Yisroel who had and accepted the version of Rashi that we have. You're going to see it quoted as early as the Maharil, which I believe was the 1400s in Germany. So you'll see that it's not something which was recently inserted. Whether it was inserted before the 1400s, I don't know. I have, presumably what I need to do is go to the manuscripts that are available. And there aren't that many, as far as I could tell from this book. There are basically one major manuscript and the earliest possible printing of Maseches Avodah Zarah's Rashi commentary. So if I can figure out how to gain access to that, because I'm not well versed in researching the different textual variants in Rashi, then I'll have to report back to you. Okay, before we get to the Bruria part, I wanted to read you something very fascinating, which really could be grist for an entire other shiur on the subject of Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan and his martyrdom, which we learned last week. In the Sefer Otzros Ha'agada, Ein Yaakov, which I've shown you before, one volume is simply telling you who has something to say, Mari Makomos, which sfarim talk about a particular Agadata, and the other volume is his own interpretations of Rabbi Moshe Tsuriel, who has written many collections of sfarim, refers to them in the course of his book, Bnei Brak, 1999. So he suggests that Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan, remember the whole thing began with a conversation between Rabbi Yossi Bar Kisma, was it? Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan, where the former had urged him to stop teaching in public because the Romans decreed against it. He continued to do so, and then this other rabbi, and he asked him, am I going to get Olam Haba? And he says, Klum ma'ase bo liyodcha, did anything ever happen to you? Well, money that was really my own got put into the tzedakah, and I spent it on tzedakah, so he says, well, that's a good sign, you'll have Olam Haba. And then after the funeral of this rabbi, the Romans found him on the way back teaching Torah publicly with the Sefer Torah, and they executed him. And the Basco said, indeed, that he did get Olam Haba. So the question is, there seems to be a machlokas between these two rabbis, whether he should be teaching Torah or Rabbim or not. What is that machlokas based on? So he has a fascinating suggestion. Nir Ali, Shemachlokas Gidolei Olam Halalu. He, Im Ra'ui Lo La'adam Limsor Nafsho Al HaMitzvos, Gam b'matzav she'eno mechuyav al pidin la'asoska. Is it a worthy thing? Is it a praiseworthy thing to seek martyrdom, to give up one's life for a mitzvah, even in a situation where one is not legally obliged to do so? It's not kiyum ha'arayos shvichus damim m'ravon hazara, let's say. You're going to say, but maybe you're obliged to over here because it was a time of Shmad, and during the time of Shmad, you have to give it up for even the smallest thing. I understand. He's not saying
that.
Right. He is assuming that for what was at stake over here, or the difference between what Rabbi Yossi Bar Kisma said you should do and what he said you should do, that difference was not requiring of martyrdom. That's his assumption, yeah.
What is occupation schmarrn?
A decree of, to violate one's religion. So the Romans decree against the teaching or the public teaching of Torah would be considered schmarrn. So the Gemara says,
teaching publicly, you're putting your life at risk, but if you secretly,
so apparently
you still pass it on without putting your life at risk.
Right, right. So James might still argue that the idea of yielding to the point, not teaching it publicly, would also be conceding something when they're trying to get you to violate your religion. And you're supposed to give up your life at a time of Shmad for even the decree to tie your shoes in a different way. Arkas on the Nisana, the example given. So without getting into what definitions are, assuming that he wasn't required to give up his life, but he chose to do so, and he maintained that that was a praiseworthy thing to do, and the rabbi who said, I'm not so sure about it, said that it's not a praiseworthy thing to do. Yadua shezu machlokes ha-Rambam ve-ha-Tosfos. This is a well-known controversy between the Rambam and Tosfos. And he says, if you look in my Sefer Otsos HaTorah, I pointed out that the Tosfos were going according to a Yerushalmi, and the Rambam according to a Gemara in the Bavli, which sounds like, so basically saying, it's really Machlokas Bavli and Yerushalmi, Machlokas Rishonim, and here it might even be a Machlokas Tanoim, as to whether you should give up your, whether it's praiseworthy to give up your life for a mitzvah when you don't have to, or should you say no, if you're not required to. Hashem wants you to stay in Olam Hazeh and do mitzvot and achieve spiritual things that way. V'hine davar pela. But there's something very amazing and strange going on here. Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion Yashav Kafuf Lefnei Rabbi Yossi Vishal Ma'ani La'olam Haba. He sat there clearly subordinating himself to the older rabbi, and he asked, am I going to get Olam Haba? Which apparently meant he had accepted what he had said, that he is sinning by the fact that he is inviting death. But nevertheless, we find that he continued to teach Torah publicly afterwards. Ki acharei mitat Rabbi Yosef hazru haromim mehaspeid alav umitzauhu l'Rabbi Chanina melameid Torah barabim v'sefer Torah munaklo v'chaykar, because after the funeral, they came back and the Romans found him teaching publicly, holding the Torah. Klomar, im hayadorish barabim ba'al pedul v'ad, had he taught publicly, but only ba'al pedul, by word of mouth, without the Torah in his lap. Harei ha-yasipet b'yodo la'atzor b'yiburo v'l'shok b'his karei ha-romim l'nankom ha-asipa. Then when the Romans got close, he could have said, and that's the way it looked when Bobby Thompson hit the shot that was heard around the world. Or he could have just kept quiet, and then they would not have said that he was teaching Torah.
Or they could have all pulled out their ear
caps. Exactly, or their bows and arrows.
Isn't that one of the reasons why they often put it in parables, you know, so that the Romans wouldn't understand what they were teaching?
Possibly, but he was not trying to conceal it. It was not with the Sefer Torah in his lap. Ola HaSeves, Diburolu Nosei Acheri, could have changed the subject. V'lo Yedu HaRomim, how about those Yankees, you know? And the Romans wouldn't have known that he was teaching Torah in public. Avo Kevan Shebetoal, Hanir El Einayim, Hefazik Sefer Torah Befeiko, since he was holding the Torah publicly in his bosom, Harehu Bekach Mefarsein La'enei HaRomim Shehu Over on Zerosam. He was publicly giving him a patch in front of him. Look at me, I'm violating your gezerah. But oh, im laham shech l'lmod Torah, ra'uy lo l'lmod b'shnei atzmo. The whole point was he wanted to continue learning. Okay, learn yourself privately, gezantahai, do the da. Man yemar shehu mechuyav atla hakil ki losu l'lamed atla atzer. Who says that he is required to gather people and teach it publicly? So James will say that he's got to pass the Torah on, he's got to make sure the Torah isn't forgotten, because not everybody is as great as he is to continue learning, or as capable as he is to continue learning independently. But you see his point.
But on the other hand, if you're dead, you can't face anything wrong anyway.
This is a also true.
All your teachers are coming out and doing this.
Pretty soon,
no teachers, then you have nothing. Mm-hmm.
So why did he do all this? Hello. Who asa kimo Rabbi Akiva? He was following the example of Rabbi Akiva, she'amar, kol yomai ha'isi mitzta'er al pasuk zeh, v'chol nafshecha afilu notelas nafshecha, amarti masai yavo liyadi v'akayemena. Rabbi Akiva, when he was, remember the scene of his execution by the Romans, he said that all my life I have yearned, basically, for the pasuk, love God with all your soul, even if he takes your soul away. And I always ask, when will this come to me that I'll have a chance to fulfill it? Which, if you read it in this context, it sounds like he was yearning for the opportunity of martyrdom. When you come to think about it, you know, we wouldn't have said it ourselves, but now when you set it in this context, it's a possible interpretation. וגם רבי עקיבא היה נוהג כך להקל קהילות ברבים למרות סכנה איומה של גזירת ייסורים. He also taught Torah in public, despite the decree that they would torture and kill anybody who did so. ושמא יש לומר כי התלמוד הבבלי האוסר לעשות כך, עושה כדין השגרתי. והירושלמי המתיר למסור נפש כוסי לפי מידס החסידוס כמין הכלל תושבי ארץ ישראל. So he says, maybe you have to say that the Bavli that doesn't allow you to do it, it's giving you the official din. The Yerushalmi that actually allows you to do this is, in fact, telling you that according to Amidas Chassidus, if you want to be extra righteous, you're allowed to. It's not a sin. And he relates it to the practice of those who lived in Eretz Yisrael. He refers you to a Ramban on Shemos Kaf, who quotes on the Pasuk of the Shomrei Mitzvosai, the observers of my mitzvos, the Pasuk in Aseres Hadibros, Eilu Shehem Yoshvim Be'eretz Yisrael, V'nosnin Nafsham Al HaMitzvos. Refers to those people who live in Eretz Yisrael and give their soul for the mitzvos. Meaning, in this context, they're Moser Nefesh. We talk about being Moser Nefesh, you know, Mishen Meimis Atzmo Aleha. But people who figuratively, they're willing to make sacrifices. But this isn't sacrifices, this is literally Moser Nefesh for mitzvos. Mm-hmm. Right. And he says that even though we're talking about the fulfillment of the mitzvah aseh as opposed to avoiding or violating a losa aseh, and the Ramah writes that when it comes to a mitzvah aseh, you're not obligated to be moser nefesh, but those who lived in Eretz Yisrael went within the strict letter of the law and were moser nefesh even for such a thing. And the Rebbeinu and Chagin and Rabbi Akiva can be read in that same tradition. And he quotes a Shach, the Sifsei Kohen, on Shulchan Aruch over there, on that Ramah, who allows people to do it if they want to, allows people to be Moser Nefesh for an Aser. Not the way the story is told in the Gemara. It's interesting. And I don't know what the historical truth, but there's the historical truth and there's what the Gemara wants to learn from it.
You got a person, I mean, you take out the phone and then you put them on for the text, right? If you look in the old city of Jerusalem, you notice that some synagogues are like very low and others are very, you know, stand out quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
I think that's, you know, definitely along those same lines.
A sort of a mood.
Yeah.
I mean, a machin. The idea of having a low place where the chazan davens from is the idea of davening mima amakim from the depths.
Yeah.
So that's another halachic outgrowth of the sugya. And perhaps at some future time we'll do an entire shiur on that issue of whether one is allowed to be moser nefesh on some situations which are not required according to the strict letter of the law. I mean, it goes against our grain. You know, we've been trained that the greatest Kiddush Hashem is living of Kiddush Hashem, not dying for Kiddush Hashem, but attitudes towards martyrdom as Havdil Elef Alfei Havdolos. You see what attitudes are being fostered in the Islamic world now towards martyrdom. Interesting too. So martyrdom for Jews, there are differences between groups of Jews and societies of Jews. Well, you find that in Yahadus Ashkenaz, right? You find a lot more. There's no such a thing as the Anusim, the Maranos or the Conversos in Christian Ashkenazic Jewry. But somehow, when faced with similar things, Jews of Spain in the Sephardic tradition sooner yielded and became closet Jews, and then later had the issue of guilt and whether they can come back to Jewish society and what's required and so forth. Professor Chaim Soloveitchik has an article analyzing the Sephardic tradition with respect to this. And an article that I made reference to last week, you know, gave a shiur on last year. The Jews of Ashkenaz were much more into giving up their lives based upon stories that they accepted from the Gemara, like those 400 kids and other such stories.
It's also a fact that the same reason, it depends on your viewpoint whether or not you want to accept Christianity as a Holy Torah.
Okay.
I mean, especially if it's Catholicism, where they've got, you know, a petal on every block. But a Mohammedan person is worshipping Hashem with a different name. And their religion is a lot closer to ours.
There's also not to too much for that kind of words, but do you want...
Just try to think.
Just a
little bit. Is it the diet of Mark?
Are you listening to it?
whether or not we like it, even whether or not we are aware of it, we've always been influenced by the culture surrounding us. And medieval Christianity, much, much more than medieval Islam, placed a very high value on martyrdom. And might that
be very interesting to explore. But another very interesting.
They venerated people who had been killed horribly.
Yeah, well, let's just say the early saints were all martyred.
You got to be a saint by being killed horribly in your religion.
Just to add two more points, if I recall correctly, the article of the Ashkenazic tradition by Abraham Grossman, a learned historian in Israel, also points out that there may be some basis to this in the tradition accepted by Ashkenazic Jewry concerning what exactly happened in Beitar. What was the Masada, not Beitar, Masada. Whether it was considered a heroic act of suicide or not. Their sources for what happened there, what they accepted, how they understood the story, may have fed into their view of what positive martyrdom. Finally, the Ashkenazic tradition, where did it come from? Which tradition did it draw on?
Eretz Israel.
And if this is true, that the Eretz Israel had the tradition of going with Nim Mishura Sadin and being Moser Nefesh more, that may also have fed into the Ashkenazic view.
Whereas Sephardim drew on the Babylonian tradition, and there they weren't persecuted. You know, they were basically allowed to...
And the Talmud Bavli also says not to do it, in cases where it's not necessary.
Generally, it's not focused on the problems of the Talmud Bavli.
We do.
On what basis was the Grand
Tunnel? They understood that the Bavli said the normative ruling is not to, but if you want to be machmir as a minas chasidos, you may. But on that, there was no machlokes.
And he said, if somebody comes to you, put the gun to your head and says, here's a toilet, throw it on the floor and get all over around on a sheet loop, what should you do? And I didn't know that he had heard this frequently in class, and I just looked at him. And I went, Rabbi, help! I ran down the hall to the nearest authority in the school and said, what do I do with this? But then they explained to me that they've been discussing some actual events that had taken place, I think during the Holocaust, where someone who was an absolute non-Jew almost, you know, in his belief, was given that choice, actually allowing up to try to do it. He wanted to know on what basis he tried to do it.
Presumably he felt that it was the time like James was describing, where they simply wanted to get you to violate their religion.
Right.
The sheets that you have before you are the Bruya sheets, the Bruya file. The top is the Rashi that we found so unusual. Just to read it once more, V'ikud de'amre mishum ma'asa de Bruya. Some say that Rameir was forced to run away from Eretz Yisrael to Babel because of the incident of Bruria. Shepa'am achat ligliga al ma she'amru chachamim nashim da'atan kalot hein alayhu. Once she made fun of what the chachamim said, that women, their da'as is kal upon them. Whatever that means. I'm not even going to touch it with a 10-foot pole, and I know many tall people from Poland who wouldn't touch it either. Rabbi Amarla, and the mayor said to her, Chayayach, by your life, so faith lehodot ledivrehem, you will end up admitting that the rabbis are right on this one. V'tzivah le'echad mitalmidav le'nasotah le'dvar aveira. I wonder whether that was the word we had in the Gemara, or did we have lefatota? It comes to the same thing. He ordered one of his Talmidim to try and test her by trying to seduce her, l'dvar aveira, which means to an act of infidelity. V'hiftsir ba yamim rabim, the Talmid persevered, because that's all the Rebbe asked, you know. Ad she nitratzeit, until she consented. Ukeshen nodala, it sounds like it never took place, but when she found out that she'd been had, and that she had failed, and thus proved that her das was kal, because it seems to mean that women can be worn down in some sense, or their das is not as, you know, steadfast. That's what it seemed to mean also in the story of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his wife. His wife was feeding them, bringing them food in the base medrash, and he said the Romans might capture her and torture her, and Noshim Da'atan Kalos. She'll reveal where we are because she's not able to resist the pressure as much as a man might be. That seems to be the common thread between these two times that it's used anyway. Well, so when she found out, Chanka Atzma, she choked herself to death, she hung herself. The Arak Rabbi Meir Machmat Kisufa, Rabbi Meir ran away because of embarrassment. Okay, so I thought that to understand this, it would really pay to understand, if we assume that this is true, and I don't have any sources that say that it's not true, but again, I have not researched, I don't have the tools to research it right now at my disposal. One would need at the very least to put it in context with the rest of the references to Bruria in the Shas. And I know where not to look. There's a new book out. Well, it's not really fair. There are plenty of books that will not mention this Rashi when they talk about her. There's a new book out that was published by the OU called The Women of the Talmud.
by Dr. Aaron Blatt, who I think was actually at NYU at the same time that I was. If I recall correctly, he was on the bowling team. And he now has did a study on women and putting together whatever the Gemara says about them, particular individuals like Ruria, like Yalta, the wife of Rav Nachman, and so on and so forth. And whatever, it's a cheerful book. It's a compendium of things that are basically known. But Ruria comes out purely favorably. And this piece is not mentioned at all. Likewise, in what I found to be a very useful compendium I have at home, was actually a bar mitzvah gift way back when, in prehistory, back when I was writing thank you notes with charcoal. It's called Encyclopedia L'Chachmei HaTalmud by Margolios. And under the entry on Ruria, he's very good, he quotes where everything can be found, and he puts it all into a nice, he doesn't just quote little sources, he tries to tie them together as an essay. And he doesn't quote that Rashi either. And you can tell that some people purposely leave it out. It sort of like doesn't fit into the rest of the picture. Because Bruria, aside from that, comes across as being a very formidable and capable person.
If somebody sets himself forward to comment as distinguished from commentaries, how many he gets?
Well, it's not. I can't talk.
Compilations. Do they include other things that are
they not include midrashim. That's for sure.
Midrashim that are not included.
Exactly.
And they do include.
Oh yeah. Well, I don't know if this is a midrash at all. I don't know where this. I don't know what the origin of this is.
The point is, if it comes from something,
he doesn't do that either. He doesn't say Shamati. He just quotes it like this. Well, now what do we know about Bruria? Well, we know her relatives. We know that her father was martyred, and that she presumably saw it. We know that her mother, the same source that says that her father was martyred, says that her mother was killed by the Romans. And then it says that her sister was taken by the Romans and put into a house of prostitution. There is another source in Masechas Simachos that says that her brother was killed by Listen. Was killed in a mugging. So she has lost her father and her mother, and basically her sister and her brother. And then you look at the Midrash and Mishle, and you see what happened to her two sons. Remember that famous story? And one day,
somebody
looked into a jewel and then you get someone like back when you do it. Right. And he said then you have to return them and she said, well, why don't you do this? Now this is quoted in the Midrash Mishle. Well, listen to the way she does it. The bottom source on the page, the Midrash Mishle, Parash Alam and Alam. For those who just don't know Mishle by heart, you do know Lamed Aleph by heart. Lamed Aleph is Eishes Chayil. And you can tell the positive spin put on it, on this story, by the Midrash, because it puts it onto the pasuk of Eishes Chayil, Miyimza, who can find the woman of valor. Amru, Ma'asah Hayab Rabbi Meir Shahya Yoshe Vidorish Beveis HaMidrash B'Shabbos B'Mincha. He was sitting in the Beis HaMidrash Shabbos afternoon, and he was giving a shiur. U'meisu Shnei Bonah. And his two sons died at home. Me'asta Iman, what did their mother do? Doesn't mention her by name. Nicha Shnehem al Hamita, put them on a bed, Upirsa Sadin Alayan, spread a sheet over them. Seen out of Quincy. Bimotsa'i Shabbos, Bola Rabbi Meir, mi Beis HaMedrash Leveso, he comes home that night. Amra Omar Allah, Heitan Shnei Bonai, where were my two sons? Amra Leveso HaMedrash Halukhu. What's the Beis HaMedrash? Omar Allah. See, PC the Beis HaMedrash the Lo Isi Yosam. I checked there, they're not there.
Would you believe?
Would you believe two Boy Scouts in a rowboat? It sounds like a line out of Get Smart. Anyway. Nosno lo kosho havdala vehivdil. She gave him the cup to make havdala and made havdala. Now, why might she have done that from a halakhic viewpoint?
Because, yeah.
Well, Shabbos is over.
But you can't do your regular work until you've done havdala.
Exactly. Once you know that your relative passed away, you're an owner, and you can't make havdala. And that's also a pretty awkward feeling. Chazar v'yamar hechan shnei bonai. He asked again. Amra lo halukhu l'makom acher v'achshav heim boi. Oh, they went somewhere else. They're on their way back. She's stalling. Hekriva l'chorach ha-ma'achal v'achal u'birer. She brought him a meal. At least he should have a good meal and be able to make the brachos and be able to bench. I mean, why would it have to specify here at B-Rech that he made a brach? Of course, you know, it's like Vayisi Yaakov Be'er Shava, when Yaakov go out without a yarmulke. The proof that, you know, so of course he made his brachos and of course he benched afterwards. So why does that tell us? Because she was doing this, so he should still be able to make the brachos. And he wouldn't feel comfortable if he were an owner and he wouldn't be able to. Liachar Shabire stresses it again. Only after he benched, Amra lo Rebbe, She'ela achas yesh lish olacha. I have a question. I have a shayla. Amar lo, Imri She'ela Saif. Yes. Amra lo Rebbe. I don't know. Dina doesn't call me that way. Except when she wants to get my attention in shul, and I'm not paying attention, so sometimes she'll say, Rabbi Rosenberg, because everybody else who says that gets my attention. No, but here, there was nobody else. She wasn't trying to get to leave and go home. Kodem hayom bo'odom echa v'nasan l'pikoto. Sometimes previously, somebody came and entrusted me with an object, a pikoto. The actual bo'litolo, so and now he wants to take it back. Nasir lo olo, should we give it back or not? Oh my love, Biti, Misha Yesh Pikadam Esla Vusarakla Zero Lirabo. Whatever has Pikadam has to return it to its rightful owner. Oh my love, Rebbe, Kuf Midaato Lohayisi Nasenas Esla. Had it not been for you, I wouldn't give it back. If you didn't agree, I wouldn't give it back. But since you say so, Me Ostav Tfastaro Biyadav, so she then took him by the hand, the Ve'ela Oso Lioso Feder, took him to that room. The Kiva also Lamita brought him over to the bed. The Natla Sadin Me'alehem and took the sheet from on them. The Rosh Mehem Mesim Munatim Ahamita. And he saw him lying there dead. This till both of the Omer. Bonai, Bonai. Rabbi, Rabbi. My sons. My teachers. Bonai v'derek eretz v'rabai shalayim v'irin bonai v'torosan. They're my children in terms of, you know, biologically, but they're my rebbeim because they lit up my face with their Torah. The osa sha'a omro lo l'rabi meyer rebi lo kach omarti l'cho ani tzorich l'hachzir ha'pikadon omarti li ani tzorich l'hachzir ha'pikadon l'rabo. Didn't you tell me that I have to give the pikadon back to its rightful owner? Omar, Hashem Nasan Vashem Lakafti Hishem Hashem Bevorah. At that point, she brought him to the level where he was able to say the Pasuk in Iyo, the quintessential Tzidka Din. Hashem has given, Hashem has taken away. Blessed be the name of Hashem. Amar Rabbi Hanina, in case you know if she had done the right thing, Rabbi Hanina says, Bidavar Hazeh Michanto Benisyash Vodata. Through this, she comforted Rabbi Meir. And he had a Yishuv Hadas, he had an emotional recovery of some sort. Women can do that are few and far between. But this seems to be a very positive appraisal of what she did. It was an entrusted object.
Just one entrusted object, and we both heard it as.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering where they. There must be. Well, if there is a. Well, it's. The. very interesting. I did a search, very funny, I did a search for the name Uriah, and this came up. Only her name is Nimit.
So the good indexer was indexing, even though it's not the text, is to be handed to the authority of the text, and indexing is the
Now, so we also, so we see this is a woman who lost her both parents violently, as well as her brother and her sister, and her two sons who died prematurely. So one has to assume to be able to not just withstand all of that, but to be able to also be the strong one to bring her husband through it, to do what she did. You have to be made of some very stern material.
Probably should be pointed out when we describe the Abraham and the Yiddish as having the dots returned, which
implies
that it
could,
in some way, left or altered somehow. It's not her, but him.
Now, it also stands to reason that somebody with that sort of strength, that sort of character, would come out in other ways as well. And let's take a look at some of the other ways in which it comes out. The source right before this, Rabbi Yossi HaGlili, Abba the Orta, he was going along the road, Ashkechei LeBruria, he bumps into Bruria, Omar Allah, he said to her, Be'ezo Derech Neleik Leluk. What road should I take to get to Lud? An innocent question, no?
Apparently.
Al Raleigh, she said to him, Galili Shotet. You fool, Galili. Lo kach amru chachamim al har basifa im ha'isha? Didn't the rabbi say that you're not supposed to speak more than necessary with a woman? That she's quoting the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Oyel ha'lomar, what you should have said was, Be'ezel Lud. You could have cut it down to two words and said, which to Lud? Okay, I mean the next one, I'm not sure how it will fit into to our speculations, but it says, yeah, it's very harsh. So do you understand what I'm saying? You see, I'm doing something very speculative and I'm not a professional. And even if I were, you can't diagnose somebody based upon stories, see if you can have fun trying. Somebody who had to have the strength to deal with what she dealt with had to have a certain type of character, and a certain type of strength. She had a... she was one of these women made of iron, perhaps. One of these... whatever, she had to have a certain hardness to her, a certain harshness, even a certain extremeness to her, to be able to sort of hold on to faith in the face of what she had been through. And it had to be, you know, the I'm right, the my way or the highway type of thing. And I think that came across over here. Then it says, Bruya Ashkate Rahuta Mida Dahava Kondoras Kulatisha. She saw a Talmud who was learning, but in a whisper. He wasn't saying sort of out loud as he was learning. He was just saying quietly. Bashabe, I don't know exactly what that means, but it's she at least figuratively gave him a clock. And she said to him, Lokak Kussel, doesn't it say, Arucha Bakol Ushmura? In Arukla, the Ramach in Arishalpa, the Torah is set up through all of your limbs, meaning your mouth as well. If you say it out loud, well then Mishtameres, it'll be preserved. The Elav ain't a Mishtameres, but if you don't say it, it will not be. So at the very least we see here that she did not hesitate to be a self-appointed Mashtiyah. That's where Yeshiva bought her. Okay, fine.
Uh-huh.
Now there is the one above that. This is not her doing anything, but it is something about her reputation. Now, Simloy also came to Rabbi Yochanan. He came to Rabbi Yochanan. Well, then, this is Mar Sefer Yochanan. Can you teach me Sefer Yochanan? Which is, it's not your standard fare. Well, it's not like a regular Masechta. It's more like a work of genealogical nature. But I don't know too much about it. So Omar Loi, Behechanak, where are you from? Omar Loi, Miluot. Behechan Mosavah, and where do you partly live? Binahardoi. And he says, Omar Loi, Ein di donin below the Ludin, below the Nahardoi. He was doing a put down. He said, I have this rule of not getting involved with the Ludin or Nahardoi. And Kosher and you were from both. You came. So then he insisted, and forced him, and he finally agreed that he would teach him this. Teach it to me in 3 months. Shakal kala pasakta, he took something and hit him with it or something. He showed him graphically that he's being critical of his desire to learn this sefer in 3 months. He said, Amalai, Ma Bruria, the Hisu de Rabbi Meir, Rate Rabbi Hanania, the Tushalim, Hanania, the Tragyam, the Sanya. Slash mea shmeitza biyoma, mishlosh mea rabbasa, the ahilu hafi wa yonsisa yidei falvasa betzlash shanim, the yata mark betzlasa yarfe. Gloria, the wife of the mayor, the daughter of Yechanina Mechadya, who used to learn 300 halachos a day from 300 different rabbanim. And nevertheless, she wasn't able to finish this even in 3 years, and you intend to finish it in 3 months. So he was using her as a model for Talmud Torah. To make a point to the students. Now there's got to be something in here of why this is a specific example. I mean, it's interesting, first of all, that this is not, he wasn't using this as, he wasn't being asked here to teach Masechus Brachos, Shabbos. It was Sefer Gibson, which almost sounds like, for some reason, associating Bruya with something which is learning but yet not learning. But I don't know. I'm not sure what to make of it. So we'll leave it at the idea that she is quoted in conjunction with rabbis in a positive way for her knowledge. And there are places where she's quoted in the Talmud where a rabbi will say, Bruya is right. She said this, and we paskin like that. Against other rabbis.
Page. Here it's from the Medrash Tilum. I do not believe that it mentions her by name in the cross-reference of Masechas Brachos. I don't think so. It didn't come up on the search, despite being an index search, I suppose it didn't come up. But in the Medrash Tilum, start on the third line, Reb Meir, Havaleahu Mina Bishivavuse. There was a certain sectarian, maybe an early Christian, in the neighborhood of Rav Meir. He was bothering him in the Gemara and Brachos. It doesn't say Bikroi, doesn't say about what. You might think that it had nothing to do with religion. You might have thought it had to do with, you know, business or just stam. It's not clear from here. It seems that he was quoting him psukim that perhaps were trying to be used as debate points in Christianity and Judaism. Kroyar Psukim. Havaboi Rachame Ale Delemus, or Meir was davening that this min should die. Umra Le Bruya Itse, or Meir's wife Bruya said to him, Mahu Date, what are you thinking? Mishun Nechsivi Tamu Chatoim? You think because we daven that Chatoim should be finished, should be destroyed, the last pasuk in Baruch Hashem. So that's why you're davening that he died. Miksiv chotim, It doesn't say chotim. It says chatoim ksiv. And chatoim can be understood to mean the sins as opposed to the sinners. Now the fact is that in the pasuk, simple pshat is that there's a parallelism. Yitam of chatoim min ha'aretz u'rishoim odeina. That it's really a repetition. And chatoim, people who sin so much, some point out, I believe it's the Mesivos, Yaakov Melisa, that sometimes you're called a chato when you become so sinful that you become the embodiment of sin. So you become called by the same name as the sin itself. So it's really talking about the people according to simple pshat. But she, on a level of drash, is saying it doesn't say chotim, which is the obvious way of saying sinners, it says chatoim, which we can translate as meaning yisofun chayovaya, may the sins be destroyed, miyad urishoim odinam, and automatically the sinners will no longer exist, there'll be nothing for them to do. They'll have to take up a different line of work.
If there are no sins left, there couldn't possibly be wicked people.
It's like decriminalizing marijuana. So Bo'i Racha Me'alayhu Dilahedru B'tiyufta. So she said you should actually daven for them instead, that they should be tshuva, as opposed to davening for them that they should die. Thinking that the Gemara in Brachos says that he did, and that they did do tshuva. But, so how are we to read this? At least on one occasion, she bested her husband. And the husband assumed one way, and she assumed another way, and she seems to have prevailed. So, you know, they always ask you, what do you want to marry, a wife or a chavusa? You know, what is more important to you to find in your wife? Some people are zocha and they marry both. Some people are not zocha and they marry both. A certain gadol in Eretz Yisrael who was married to a daughter of a really great gadol. And Rav Schechter, you know, once mentioned how this man was not happy because she always thought that nobody could learn like her father. So, imagine. So here is Bruria, the woman who could learn like a man, and the woman who could defeat the men when it came to learning, the woman who even bested her husband, Rabbi Meir, and who basically almost treated him like her child when it came to getting him through the Avelos for their children. She was the one who was milumedes in how to survive loss, and she basically, literally, took him by the hand and got him through it as you would a child.
How old was she when her father was executed?
But it seems that this may have come, you know, this can't have come without a price. You know, if a woman is going to survive all of those losses, she either needs to be a certain type of woman or needs to become a certain type of woman to be able to survive those things. And that character that she developed can be reflected in the way she behaves in some of these other stories, the way she becomes sort of extreme, strict, perhaps harsh. Are you about to say something?
Can you take a look at the very first story? What is her...
So she's objecting.
Characterization. How, in what fashion, does she express her disagreement with the opinion of her husband with regard to women's status?
So it's a ligliga.
Which means mocked.
Mocked.
It doesn't sound like her either.
But it suggests something also.
What?
For her to say that she prepared to mock with a comment is a pretty strong level.
It's a pretty strong level, and also on that particular halacha, that particular statement of theirs, who are they to tell me what women can take? Has a single one of the chachamim been through what I've been through? I've survived my parents, my brother, my sister, my children,
But it's one thing for her to dispute and a different thing for her to
talk. Uh-huh. Except this, she felt perhaps so strong about this that she couldn't even entertain this as a debate. It was a source of absolute absurdity to her that anybody could say, because her whole life was built around being the opposite of Nashim, Dait, and Kalos. What they were saying about this denied her reality. And then what happens? She who had bested her husband on this one loses to him. But she didn't just lose to him. By seeing that they were right and she was wrong, that destroyed her. Because everything that she stood for, everything that she was, her whole character, was that she was not Da'at of Kalat, but she was a survivor. That she stood for the strength to...
But there's something else. He's Ekeros.
Yeah.
And he did something that was really vicious. Which meant she could never trust this man.
Which doesn't sound like him either.
It doesn't sound like him either, but the thing is, after all she'd been through, she had nothing left with him. And now she couldn't depend on him either.
But you also have to wonder what kind of a marriage they had in the first place, because there was not a partnership here. She infantilized him, you might say, when it came to the Avelis.
I'm not sure that's fair.
Well, I don't know if it's fair.
I think she was being kind to him.
Okay. But you know something? I mean, I know you can read this in more than one way. And I think that in the context in which it was said, it was meant as praise. But you know, if it happened, God forbid, and it should never happen in one of our families, could you imagine how I would feel, God forbid, if Dina did that instead of coming to tell me immediately? I don't think it's a matter of halakha.
Okay, so
I think it's a matter that if you have a marriage of equals, one doesn't think about these things. One simply says, this happened, we have to face it as a team.
Except, I would agree with you, and generally I'm all about the communication, you know, that if something happens to you. Which is why I also don't like the called the mining in order and some of the students to seduce her in whatever fashion that was meant. But the final line of this says that this did in fact comfort him and which meant that she knew him well enough to know what approach would work best.
Well, number one, what happened in the story and how the story was interpreted by somebody else later can be two different things.
True, but all we have is the story.
I understand, but the story is a composite of what happened and how somebody later interpreted it. But even granted that it did, then I think one has a right to ask, what does this show about Reb Meir also? Reb Meir, in other words, you have two people here. He's a pretty tough guy also. This is their marriage is a very interesting specimen of marriage. And it's pretty clear that there was a certain amount of competition going on, where she one-upped him, and he was trying, when it came to Chatoim and Chotim, and he was trying to one-up her when it came to Nashim, Da'at, and Kalos. Now, I'm not quite sure how healthy that is. But what he didn't realize was that what he was trying to one-up her on was a lot more essential to her core than what she one-upped him on. And when she lost on that one, she lost more than a bet. And maybe was left when her core reality is shattered, that she doesn't have that strength, there was nothing left for her. So that may have been the build-up for that ration.
Definitely, you know, she's a pretty stubborn woman.
Yes.
And, you know, which can be good and can be bad.
Mm-hmm. Well, people.
That so much of herself is invested in not being held up and being stubborn and strong. That is exactly why I thought, this is exactly why I find it so difficult to believe that she would have given in the first place. But increasingly, the picture we're getting of both of these people, I'm finding very hard to reconcile with Russia's story. Every single element of Russia's story, in fact, that, well, except for the, except for Anna trying to say that he might prove her wrong on the issue of Torah, that I could believe, but her mocking the Hakamim, him sending a student to seduce her, her being seduced, her killing herself, and him running away. None of this sounds anything like the people we are reading about elsewhere. I'm finding it very difficult.
It's very hard to believe that he's something that disgusting. It doesn't seem to fit with his core personality.
I haven't got an answer for that. I mean, it remains a very difficult
question. But where did he feel it? Where did he get this story from?
How else would he be able to be there?
By creating a position, a thing that is so sinful. This doesn't.
How else would he be able to?
Why?
This is what I hear.
Oh!
This is what I always tell my married couples.
Do this. I mean, it's like this is such a firm guy that I can't see how he could possibly do such a thing.
I don't know if I told it to you guys.
All men have their nonsense.
But every couple that I'm about to marry has to hear the same spiel. And one of the spiels has to do, one of the points I make is about how to argue. And part of how to argue is don't win the battle at the expense of losing the war. I mean, when married couples know the buttons to press, they know the insecurities, they know the things that have been confided into them, and they could easily win an argument by resorting to those buttons, but at the cost of irreparable damage to the marriage. And if the story is true, that's exactly what her mayor did. But
maybe it was a matter of pride on his part. It's like, you know, here's a woman who's smarter than me.
But don't, that's what I'm trying to develop is... Yeah, she doesn't know her place. Because I'm the liberated man who is secure enough in my own knowledge to be able to marry a woman like this and not feel overshadowed or threatened. But you know, after a certain number of years of getting it over the head, you know, my wife is, where is my wife? Oh, she's in Drisha. Where is my wife? Oh, she's in Matan. Where is my wife? Oh, she's giving the first cheer of a woman in Chovavei. You know, where is, after so many years of hearing that, and my colleagues looking at me and saying, you know, oh, there's you know, Mrs. Bruria coming into the Beis Medrash. After a while, a certain number of times of her beating me at a point, you know, it's wearing. And I feel, because if a marriage assumes an antagonistic, competitive tone to it, eventually that tone takes over and you forget what you're really doing when you're trying to win a point. Forget how cruel it can be. So, you're having fun playing amateur psychologist? Should we retreat into the area of safer halakha? The second page, so I was wondering if this would last long enough, you know. The second page I gave to you, and in fact, I could have given you a third and a fourth page also, but I decided to have Rachmanos. I searched in She'elos HaTshuvos, in the responsa literature, to see if Bruria came up. And she came up in the most interesting context. She came up in the context of women in Talmud Torah. How should we relate to her example as a woman who seemed to learn Torah, not just Torah, but the most advanced type of Torah?
And most obscure.
So the answer is we can relate to it in opposite ways, very positively and very negatively, depending upon our Rashi. How much weight are we to give to the Rashi in deciding how ultimately to size up Bruria? So take a look at the Maharil on your second page. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but he starts off by saying, "V'lomod l'nashim," teaching women Torah. You think it was just asked by, you know, Avi Weiss, Joel Wolowitzki? This is being asked, you know, in the 1400s. Even though a woman has to keep every negative commandment and every positive commandment that's not time linked, as it says in the Gemara Kedushin, you still shouldn't teach her Torah. I'm not going to try to define tiflos, it's late. Like teaching her tiflos. I'm not trying.
Give us two or three possible ones so we can get an idea.
It can mean immorality. It can mean that it's dangerous because she will take it in the wrong direction, possibly because her learning will always remain superficial and therefore she won't have a full understanding of it. The Yalef Lay, Me ani chachama shachanti orma. It's learned from that pasuk. Kevan she nifnasa chachma belibo shel adam nifnasa bo armimus. When chachma enters a person's heart, so does a certain slyness. And Rashi says on sota, on masecha sota, kaf aleph zalishono. Here's the quotation from Rashi. She mitocha hi mevina armumis veosa dvareha behatzneya. It teaches her a certain slyness, and if she decides to sin, she can hide it better. So we are concerned that she might come to some sort of immoral act. Lafisha da'atan kalos. There it is again. Afilu hava mitsuba. Afilu hafi. Karya. Afilu kihi mitzvah. Karinan ve es la'asos. The Yatzas Chara Bahafsedu, the Kholshukin the Inan Mitsubos. So basically, saying that even if somebody were Mitsuba, there are risks, and so she is Inan Mitsuba, to teach her what you would gain by teaching her would be lost because of the risks that you take of what the effects can be. And so he's recommending not teaching. Our issue is not whether women should or shouldn't. You know, in our circles we have our views and so forth and sources. But go to the bottom paragraph of these three. Omnam yosir nir'a. I guess maybe we'll read the middle paragraph too, if you have the strength. What's your objection? Yeah, then let's go. All right. So in the middle paragraph, he talks about people who seemingly shouldn't have learned, like Tevi, the Eved of Rabban Gamliel, who kept who knew things and did mitzvos. How could he have taught him? The Shifcha of Rebbe, and then three lines, the last word on the third line of from the bottom of the middle paragraph, Ubruya, last word on the line. Ubruya, the Chayotze Bazer. So Zeh Nimshach Adela'el Sheyod'u B'Kabbalah. That they did not learn texts inside, they were simply told things and passed things down, but they were not taught in a formal sort of a way. Inami shall pi avihem osu. It's our lomar de avihem savar kiben savri kiben azai. The isle perakaya notel chayab odam lalami pito Torah. Or maybe they are being taught Bruria's father of Chanina ben Tradion may have held like Ben Azai that you are obligated to teach your daughter Torah. But that is not the opinion, that is the accepted one, according to the Maharil.
Omnam Yoser Nira Li Sheme Atzmam Asub. Makes more sense to me that these people, like Bruria, learned by themselves without the approval of the rabbis. Shari Bruria Ochicha Sofa Al Tchilasa. What happened to her in the end shows what was right or wrong about what she did at the beginning. In other words, her fate, her dire fate, shows that she shouldn't have started learning in the first place. Muva Berashi, Amadazor, Yechess, Amadbeis, Ramasavika, the Amri, Shalom, Samcha, Al Divrei Chachamim, Sha'amru, Noshim, Da'at, and Kalos. She did not want to depend on what the rabbi said. Noshim, Da'at, and Kalos, Verosh, Lachachamim, Shlomo, Hamelach, Omar, Ani, Arbe, Velo Osor, Velo Ate, and Shlomo HaMelech himself thought that he could outsmart the rabbis and he could do things without violating what the Torah had in mind. She depended upon her righteousness, that she would not do what Rashi was afraid of, to come to immorality, tiflus, through the learning. And that's exactly what she came to. She agreed to have an affair. So he picks up on what I was pointing out, that the thing that she seemed to excel in was not what she should have been learning. She should have been learning what women need to know, the halachos, the practical halachos. And instead she was learning Sefer Yuchsin. So when she learned, she shouldn't have learned, and when she learned the wrong things. So the Maharil is very critical. He's not the only opinion. Since Eliezer, Eliezer Waldenberg in Eretz Yisrael, writes that there is one of the Sfarim of the Chidar of Chaim Yosef David Azulai called Tuv Ayin. He writes that when you know that a woman's kavana to learn is pure, she really wants to learn, and she is bright enough to do it, Godel Sifla, Oz Azai Mutar Gam La'aviha V'La'achirim L'lamda. And her father and others are allowed to teach her. And through this, he explains the Gemara of Pesachim of Samech Beis that we read, of how 300 rabbis, apparently, but Bruria. So apparently they saw that she was worthy and ready and capable. So Bruria is used in both directions in the debate about Talmud Torah and women. Either you see that she was the great scholar and so many rabbis taught her, or you see what happened to her in the end, and that's a proof that she shouldn't have been learning. It did her no good. She ended up falling into the pit that the rabbis were afraid of.
To me, it sounds like, you know, maybe draw the line. You know, teach them up to a certain point, but don't go too far.
Well, but maybe not. Some say, like Rabbi Moshe Meiselman, in trying to explain Noshim Dat and Kalos in his book, The Jewish Woman and Jewish Law, says that since women are never going to have the time to learn as much as the men do, therefore their knowledge will be superficial, that's the danger.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying teach it to them in the way that's specifically the danger, according to Rabbi Meisel.
I mean, it's...
I have a hard time seeing how Bruria's end was a result of learning too much.
She could have ended up in the same kid without ever having picked up a center. She could have had the same argument. You're saying I'm not wrong. And look what I've been through in my life. You're totally illiterate.
That's assuming that my interpretation is correct.
I still have this argument with you.
That's assuming that my interpretation of her life is correct, and we have no idea whether it is or not. These rabbis, the Maharil, has a different reading of her life. He says, Rashi's understanding of Nashim Da, of if you learn teach your daughter Torah, it's like teaching her Tiflis, is that it will lead her to immorality and the ability to carry on immorality with greater facility. And at the end of her life, what happens? Immorality. I don't see how the exact description of Rashi of being able to cover it up led to that. I don't see how the... Unless you say that the learning itself, because of all of the mental exercises that it causes you to do, it teaches you to think in a certain way, which can be taken in a sly, sinful direction, as in the reasoning that you'll get in certain circles for why you shouldn't pay your taxes, or why the government of Israel doesn't deserve to be treated with justifying averos based on Talmudic reasoning.
So the idea that too much learning will make you sly and crafty is not one I've ever heard in a Jewish context before. In an American anti-intellectual bias context, oh yes, but never in a Jewish context.
Well,
that was not very startling.
Really. Honestly, I'm not being familiar with the sources deeply enough, I can't address that, but we saw at the beginning of the Maharil, that when Chachma enters your heart, so does Armimus, so does some sort of slyness. What exactly that means, I think one would have to really research.
If you're learning the second on, business relations, you might say, aha, okay, now I know how to evade the law and do it legally. Now I know how to, do this and not be guilty of cheating.
There are stories of somebody who became a criminal, and the Rebbe said, I know it's this guy because when we were learning Hamatkin, he asked this question, but couldn't the shomer say and thereby escape the shvua and then be able to keep the money? That's when I knew he was going to go into a life of crime. In any event, this is the note upon which we end for the year, and I thank Yasher Koach for your faithfulness and for the joy of preparing for such a group and learning together. And Amir Tzashem, what I'm hoping to do next year with your consent is not totally give up Midrash, but go back to Gemara, learn Gemara perhaps three times, and then for the fourth week of the month, choose a topic in Midrash and do that, if that meets with your approval. If you have other desires, let me know. This way we'll...
Specifically second?
I'll still be able to scratch my itch for Midrash.
Any specific masechet, or?
I'm toying with the idea of Maseches Brachos. If anybody has a particular preference on a masechta, please let me know, and I'll give it very serious consideration. But the sooner you let me know, the better, because the summer is preparation time.